This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour served 40 years in Congress, 18 in the United States Senate, but in 2012, Maine's Olympia Snow decided not to seek a fourth term. With discord between Democrats and Republicans at all-time highs, elected officials seem unable to agree on anything or to get much of anything done, and that has led public approval of Congress to be at all-time lows. But when this Maine Republican left Capitol Hill, she didn't leave her sense of duty behind. Instead, she's been campaigning for government that works. She's written a book called Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress, in which she suggests a return to the Founding Fathers' vision of a government in which compromise is not a dirty word. Senator Snow will be the keynote speaker at the Women and Girls Research Alliance's 2014 summit at UNC Charlotte on April the 11th. We have details about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Senator Olympia Snow joins us for the hour from NPR in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Delighted to be here this morning.
You were the second woman to be elected to the Senate from Maine after Margaret Chase Smith. You're only the fourth woman in history to be elected to both houses of Congress. Was it more difficult or painful for you to make the decision to leave the Senate, or would it have been more difficult to stay and experience what was going on there firsthand?
That's a very good question. It was a difficult decision to leave because, obviously, I had been planning to run for re-election and was prepared organizationally and financially for a better part of 2 years on that endeavor. But I came to, you know, the conclusion that the polarization partisanship wouldn't diminish. So it was a difficult decision because I was going against the grain of, you know, what I had been all about and part of my legislative journey. And I'm a fighter by nature. I always attribute that to the Spartan side of my Greek ancestry. But I recognized that it wasn't going to change from within. It had to change from without. And I decided that the best way I could contribute was to talk to people across this country about how they could change it and participate. So it was a hard decision. Would it have been difficult to stay? It would have been under the circumstances and what we've seen unfold again exponentially, even since the time that I was there, you know, how much worse it's grown in terms of the polarization and the partisanship, which is what I came to recognize. It was one of those actually, you know, in the night moments when I started to contemplate the future and thinking about how the Senate would be and my role in the Senate and the future, you know, of politics. And I saw that the rise of the partisanship has really changed dramatically from where, you know, I had been, and I like to solve problems. I don't like to continue to perpetuate and to create them.
Do you think you would have won that election had you stayed in the race?
Yes. I was in great track. I mean, obviously, you never know, but absolutely. Yeah, you know, the polls look good, and there was nothing about my reelection that concerned me, but except that you cannot leave any stone unturned, and you never underestimate anyone or anything that goes on in an election. So I was full steam. That was the hard part because I was full steam ahead on the reelection. So it's like going 100 miles an hour on a brick wall. But I had to submit my signatures in about a month. That's when the reality started, you know, to start to take shape and the clarity of the moment. And I started to think about, you know what, people are asking me two questions when I was traveling the country for fundraising for my reelection. Was it going to change in Congress and how was it going to change? And so I started to settle on those two questions as I was contemplating the future.
You know, you mentioned that you realized you had to fix the Senate from outside, not from within. And they used to tell Vietnam War protesters that instead of agitating or marching or taking over buildings or burning draft cards, they would be more successful by working from within the system. So why do you feel you have to fix it from without? Why couldn't you have been just as effective as a long-term Washington congressperson and a long-term senator?
Because you see what's happening since I left, the same. I mean, in fact, it became infinitely
worse. But then people like you who believe in bipartisanship are leaving.
Yeah.
So if the bipartisan people leave, all you're left is with the extremes.
Because that's what's happened already. The problem is so much has changed on the outside that has brought to bear the kinds of pressures that you're seeing from within that has contributed to the polarization. The outside groups, the third-party groups that spend millions and millions of dollars to influence elections and even between elections, and the homogenization of political districts in the House of Representatives. And you're having much more ideological candidates emerging from the primary. So everything is predisposed towards the primary political base as opposed to the general population. So that's why you get the narrow positions being voted on, if at all, in the Senate as well as in the House. But the Senate was a place where, you know, obviously you could work across the aisle. And as you can see, you know, there's very little of it today. You know, there are instances of it, but it's a rarity. Because the kind of pressures, most senators are worried about primaries today. And as you can see, I mean, that's what's happened because the red states are getting redder and the blue states are getting bluer. And so, therefore, there's a reluctance across the aisle because they're going to incur the type of primaries that ultimately has contributed to the dissolution of the center.
So it's not the media or AM talk radio or the way campaigns are financed or the influence of corporate money in PACs that's so much the problem. It's the primary system that's the problem?
Well, it's all of that combined because it influences the primary. It's offering the polarization. When you talk about, you know, cable networks, for example, I mean, I always used to say it was defined through MSNBC and Fox News because it's the polarization. It's offering the polar opposite views. Which suggests that there is no center, there's no ability to work across the aisle because, as you said earlier, in terms of our founding fathers' envision, what I was talking about is that compromise is viewed as akin to capitulation. But it's the way the United States, the United States of America and our Constitution was founded. Based on compromise and consensus. I mean, after all, in the United States Senate, you need 60 votes. You have to build that accommodation for consensus. So it's predicated majority rule, but it also recognizes the rights of minorities. That's what makes the institution of the Senate so distinctive. But what's happened is that both sides offer polar opposite views, and then there is no opportunity in the legislative process through amendments, because that's not happening, to work across the aisle to build a much more consensus-based position on an individual issue pending before the Senate. And we've also seen what's unfolded in the House of Representatives because you don't have competitive congressional seats anymore in the House of Representatives.
I have a list in front of me. You have compiled a list of people in the United States Senate and people in the House of Representatives, listed from left to right, and smack dab in the ideological center of the Senate is North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan. And this is determined, I understand, by a person's liberal and conservative ranking. She has a 51 liberal rank and a 49 conservative rank, which puts her in the ideological center. And yet she is running for re-election here in North Carolina. And from the right, she's a Democrat, from the right, we're hearing terrible things about her. She's right smack dab in the center, but she's a traitor or a communist or an Obama liberal. What's up with that?
Well, you know, that's where, you know, I found myself. I was in the middle as well. And, you know, and that's the problem today. And I think actually people are beginning to appreciate how important the center is in the political process. I mean, if you have it all on the right and the left, then it's almost impossible, as we've witnessed time and time again with the artificially engineered crises in Congress over the last few years, that you don't have a middle from which to bridge those divisions, and you can't come up with solutions to the problems. How do you solve problems if you can't get both sides to work together, if you don't compromise? I've never known an area of life, professionally or personally, where you get 100% of what you want. And so this whole notion you jettison people because they're in the middle and they're trying to work out issues on both sides of the equation is unfortunate. And it's basically what we've witnessed here today in the political system.
When you left the Senate, you wrote a guest column for The Washington Post in which you said that two truths are all too often overshadowed in today's political discourse. Public service is the most honorable pursuit, and so is bipartisanship. So let's talk about the first of those, public service. Do you think that most of today's elected officials truly see themselves as public servants. They say so, but do they really see themselves that way, or are they there to make a name for themselves, to push a particular personal agenda, or one that funds their war chests and to make money?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that there have, you know, been some that have certainly lost sight of the purpose of public service, which is to solve problems for the people for whom, you know, who elected you. And in the United States Senate, it's your state and also the country, because only 100 United States senators, so obviously it influences the policies for the country. And I can't, you know, cast a broad brush for everybody in the United States Congress, but certainly the purpose has been lost. I've always believed in the value of public office and that it's an enormous trust to do good and to do right, do the best of your abilities, and to solve problems. It's just not to continue to perpetuate them by refusing to talk to the other side. Mm-hmm. I learned that lesson early on, Mike, when I served in the state legislature, in the State House of Representatives, and early on in my legislative career. And I understood the value of working across the political aisle that made a difference. And that's how I continued throughout public office. Doesn't mean to say you're not going to have your differences. Obviously, that's why there are Republicans, Democrats, and some independents, you know, in Congress. The point is, at the end of the day, it's about solving the problems. And that's what's been lost. It is so much about fundraising. I mean, absolutely, that has dominated the sphere of politics today. Because you've got the independent groups now that are out there spending millions, so you have to protect yourself against your opponent as well as groups that may weigh in on your race. Citizens United exacerbated that, and that was my provision that was challenged and struck down in the Supreme Court with that decision, regrettably. And the list goes on. And so people have got to go back to thinking about what is the purpose of serving in public office. It is about, you know, solving the problems, you know, facing our country today. If you can't move legislation forward, you can't move the country forward, as we've witnessed, as I said, time and time again.
Senator Olympia Snowe is our guest, former senator from Maine, also a fellow with the Bipartisan Policy Center and author of Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. I have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about your political career, because you serve both in both houses of Congress and both houses of the state legislature in Maine, which makes you a pretty much of a professional lifetime public servant. And a lot of people going to Congress today, it seems to me, are there for the very first time and are almost could be considered amateurs in the best sense of the word. They want to be there because they believe in something, but they're not professionals. We're going to come back and talk about that in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Visual Art, offering a new Think Like an Artist series June 5th and 6th, designed to help individuals activate their creativity. Details at mccallcenter.org. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, housing the homeless. Years ago, we did a program on Moore Place, an apartment complex designed and built to house the homeless. It was controversial at the time, but a new report about Moore Place, which houses 85 of the city's chronically homeless, shows that it has drastically reduced the amount of time tenants spend in the hospital, which amounts to a major savings to taxpayers. We'll revisit Moore Place and the problem of homelessness in Charlotte when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Back to our encore edition of Charlotte Talks with Olympia Snowe in just a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki testifies before Congress on treatment delays in health clinics. The FCC votes on a net neutrality proposal, and more state high courts rule in favor of gay marriage.
Join the conversation on the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. It's spring, which means out with the old and in with the new.
You saying I should clean out my desk?
Yeah, if you can find it. Actually, I'm talking about new cars. If it's time for a new ride, donate the old one.
And support this station. Call 1-866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
On listener-funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is former Maine Senator Olympia Snow, author of Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. She left the Senate because she felt better about trying to fix the problems that are obvious to everybody out there who's a citizen. She could fix them better from the outside than from the inside. And as I said prior to the break, you're one of the few people in the country who have served both in both houses of the Congress and both houses of their state legislature. You've been involved in public service for a very long time, and you came up at a time when Democrats and Republicans seemed to be able to get along and seemed to be able to talk about and compromise on issues that were important in their time, and I'm sure that dates back to your time in the Maine legislature. Whereas a lot of people coming to Congress today are there for a specific issue, a specific reason, and they didn't serve locally. They just went right to Congress in many cases. Is that part of the problem that we have? Amateur, in the best sense of the word, means somebody who does it for the love of something. So let's use it in that sense of the word. They're not professionals yet.
Right. And, you know, it is true. I mean, the lack of legislative experience, given the fact that more than half the Senate, more than half the House have served less than 6 years. So the only environment that they are accustomed to or are familiar with is the current one of dysfunction and discord. And for most part, many wouldn't know how the legislative process, you know, should work. I often said that I threatened to go to the floor and have a refresher course on how a bill becomes law, like Schoolhouse Rock, because, let's start from the beginning here, and because there was a process that made sense, because it builds consensus. You're talking to one another, debating the best of ideas and competing ideas in the committee and then on the floor. And that's the way legislation evolves. Everybody has a chance to look at it, weigh it, and even the public can weigh in as well. But as you can see today, that's obviously not happening. So you do have very little legislative experience. In fact, that's a badge of honor for many who are running for public office today.
Yeah, they're outsiders.
Some want to, eviscerate government. You know, it's interesting about that, too, because, President Reagan, and I served in the House of Representatives at the time which he was elected, and, he believed in limited government, efficient, effective government, but he wasn't about eviscerating government. And I think that there is a big difference here. And it takes work. You know, legislation and talking to one another, working with another, takes work. It takes patience. It's willing to listen to the other side. But there's none of that today because they want to score a political point to take it to the next election. So it becomes about the politics and the power, not about solving the problems at hand for the country. That's why we've deferred on so many major issues affecting this country.
And a lot of the people who are there with a particular agenda talk a lot about the initial intent of the founding fathers and taking the government back to what the founding fathers saw as what they believed to be government, the purpose and the role of government. And you said in that column in the Washington Post that the Senate was not living up to what the founding fathers envisioned. So what kind of reaction did you get to that statement among your colleagues? And what was that vision?
I think many actually would agree. The vision is that it is a consensus-oriented institution, different from the House. The House is a majority rule institution because it's obviously designed to respond to the passions of the moment, elected every 2 years. And then you have the Senate that is a more deliberative. That's why it's considered the greatest deliberative body in the world. And therefore, you sort through the issue. It takes longer, to get through the process because you obviously now have to achieve 60 votes to overcome that hurdle to pass legislation or to move it forward. But the point is, it's a way in which to have the ability to sort through the variety of issues that might emerge with a particular piece of legislation and giving all sides the opportunity to weigh in. That's the kind of process that's not happening today, as I detail in my book. It's not a deliberative body. I mean, you're not having the, you know, the amendment process, which is crucial, you know, to building support on the floor or in a committee. I mean, even the committee process isn't working because the power is now more concentrated in the hands of leadership than it is in the committee chairs in working through the issues and then sending the legislation to the floor and having an open amendment process, which is consistent with the traditions of the United States Senate, is to have that, you know, open debate. And that's simply not occurring.
Yeah, you mentioned Ronald Brownstein's observation in the National Review that Congress is becoming more like a parliamentary system in which everybody votes the party line and they use every tactic to block the other side. And that, he says, is not what America is about. So given the uniqueness of our system and the fact that you just said the Senate has long been considered the world's most, I've forgotten the exact words that you used, the best deliberative body in the world.
Right.
That's been going on for 200 plus years. Why are we gravitating to a different method that it wasn't designed to work like?
Because of the outside influences and forces in the political campaigns. You know, with these third-party groups that have amassed millions and millions of dollars and the polarization that has been underway, with respect to the political parties and obviously some of the, enormous realignment occurring within the Republican Party, that's for sure, and as a result has contributed to taking this approach rather than working out the differences. I mean, if you think about just the outside groups and what they've spent in the last election cycle, it was over $500 million, and they were attack ads. 90% of those ads that were run were attack ads, attacking the other side, demonizing the other side, you know, the opposition and their viewpoint. So, you know, all of that has a major spillover in the political process. And they've gotten focused on totally and entirely on the next election. It used to be, Mike, that after the election, you would focus on, at least in the first of the two-year election cycle, on legislation, what was important to the country. You know, understanding you had your differences. I'm not saying there was some golden era bipartisanship. What I am suggesting is that you had the opportunity to fight it out and then ultimately resolve that there are some things you're going to disagree on and then you're going to work to make sure other things can move through. And that's what you do. But now they're not even talking to one another across the table. I mean, that would be heresy today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, talking to the president or vice versa. I mean, it's just turned the whole political system and our governance on its head. And it just simply doesn't make sense. It wouldn't make sense in our own personal lives to refuse to talk to one another or in your community. So think about your community. If you didn't talk to one another because you absolutely recognize that you're opposite end of the political spectrum, you can't do that. Our country can't function under those circumstances. And, you know, Chris Matthews wrote his book about President Reagan and Speaker Tip O'Neill, and it was true. I was part of a coalition in the Democratic House of Representatives between Republicans and Democrats to move the president's economic program through. But they had fierce differences. But at the end of the day, they talked, they had drinks, they had dinner. I mean, President Reagan had them, bipartisan leaders over at the White House regularly, had bipartisan leadership meetings. And so there was a give and take, knowing that what was the purpose at the end of the day. It was all about making it a better country. And they understood that.
But the stakes, make their,
go ahead.
I'm just going to say that the stakes seem so much higher to the people who are going to Congress. At least they're making them out to be much higher. The country is in danger. We need to take our country back. That if we don't have it our way, we're going to hell in a handbasket. So we have to have it our way. In truth, if you have certain sets of beliefs, and if it was 100 years ago, you felt the same way, but somehow we did business differently. And now it seems that we have to have it our way. Because
right,
the stakes are higher than they've ever been. And that's not true, though, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, you know, and we have significant problems, but they aren't ones that we can't solve if we were willing to work together. But if you pursue absolutism, ideological absolutism, in demanding that being the ultimate solution to the problem, then ultimately, you can't move ahead. Is the question, well, you're spending too much money, right? I mean, you know, I'm an advocate for a balanced budget amendment. I have a constitutional amendment for a long time. Unfortunately, we've never been able to get there. And that was, you know, fault on both sides, frankly. But Republicans, you know, had attempted in the past to get it through. And unfortunately, we failed by one vote. But the point is here, there are solutions to the problems. It's willing to, you know, have passing budgets, frankly. I mean, that's important. That's a fundamental obligation. And yet over the last few years, we've seen in the United States Senate, we didn't pass a budget resolution up until they had that agreement in December in the aftermath of a 16-day shutdown. I mean, that's what it takes now to come to solutions to our problems and doing our basic and fundamental duties as a public official. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's regrettable that we've put this all or nothing, my way or the highway approach to governance. I always say they like to create the high noon at the OK Corral moments so that they can make the strongest points to elevate themselves for the next election, but not thinking about the implications of the country. You know, Mike, people ask me all the time, what's going to become of America, you know, if we continue this way? I mean, people are fretting. Does it mean to say that, you know, people on both sides are, you know, aren't right? No. I mean, they have some very good points. But you have to look at the issue in its entirety. Now, are there too many regulations? Yes. Well, what do we do about it? I mean, there are ways of resolving those problems. Too much spending? Yes. What do we do about it? There are ways of solving those problems. But if you refuse to sit down with the other side and to have those conversations and discussion, battle it out, and put the country on the brink, you know, which has happened time and again over the last few years to make a political point, but does nothing to advance the interests of this country, then that's another question entirely. And obviously they have lost sight of the goals of public office.
Which is part two of that quote I read from your article in the Washington Post. You said public service is a most honorable pursuit, and so is bipartisanship. And you went on to say that there is courage in conciliation and honor in consensus building with political rewards that follow. How many people would believe that, would echo that sentiment in the Senate or the House?
Well, I couldn't give an estimate. Obviously, we wouldn't know it by, you know, today's results. But there are people there who understand that.
Do they, you know, secretly there are agree with you? People. Would they acknowledge it,
yes,
publicly?
That's another question. that, you know, because there's a political price. Isn't that a sad commentary, though? I mean, that's a I understand. I have been on the front lines. So I understand the risk, but, you know, it came from my years of public office. And, you know, I was determined to be a legislative lone ranger if I had to come up, you know, to help solve problems facing this country. Because I, you know, I didn't know any other way, and I wanted to contribute to the solutions because that's what it's all about. And there are sometimes you're going to say, no, I can't agree at all. I mean, that's, you know, and that happens. But you got to give it your best faith effort. And unfortunately, the political penalty today is on those who compromise. I'm telling the American people everywhere I travel that we have got to, you know, provide a political reward for those who are willing to work across the aisle and a penalty for those who don't. The majority of Americans want our government to work, and it's not working. Mm-hmm. That's the point. If our government can't make decisions on any level, in any respect, on issues large or small, that's truly problematic. And, you know, we've postponed a number of issues that puts, you know, the economic prosperity of our country in question, especially for the younger generations when it comes to debt, job creation, economic growth. Could it be better than this? It should have been by now, and it would have been by now if the present Congress had been working hand in glove to make it so on the issues that mattered.
Would we be out of the recovery? Would we be well on our way to being healthy financially again had the Congress worked along with the president to make it happen in a swifter way?
Oh, absolutely.
Because Obama's getting all the blame for this. Does he deserve all the blame for this?
No, it's not all his fault. I mean, it's obviously it takes both the legislative and the executive branch to work hand in glove, ultimately. And that's the other part of the problem. I mean, they operate essentially as parallel universes. And that, you know, that can't happen. I mean, you've got to have both having conversations. Mm-hmm. Communications are important. And that's obviously not happening. So both should have on issues such as tax reform, which I argued back in 2009 we should have done. You know, in the aftermath of stimulus, we should have moved forward on tax reform, lay the groundwork so that when we were emerging from the recovery, business would have known what the rules of the game were, you know. And the same was true on regulation and on a debt reduction plan for the long term and passing budgets. It's the uncertainty, Mike, that has fueled, you know, the kind of, you know, subpar recovery we're in today. I mean, it's the worst post-recession recovery we've had as a result of the uncertainty that has emerged from Washington these days because not working on the key issues that mattered. So, you know, private sector standing on the sideline, that hurts the average American. It hurts job creation. Why do we have, you know, abnormally high, you know, long-term unemployment or underemployment? We should have been far beyond where we are today. There's no doubt matching any other post-recession recovery. We're clearly not there. And that's all, you know, aims at Washington.
I want to get back to deliberation in the Senate because you write about this in your book. And the Senate is known for being this great debating organization. And yet today there's not a lot of talking and there's not a lot of listening because there's not a lot of talking. You say that few bills, even when you were there, few bills even reached the floor. And when they did, debate was frequently stifled or curtailed by overuse of the filibuster and other procedural gymnastics. All too frequently, a bill was drafted behind closed doors, reported to the floor, and then a quick up-and-down vote was forced on the entire proposal. That's coming from the inner workings of the United States Senate, not because of some constitutional rule. Why has it devolved into that?
Because they want to make the political points and don't want to solve the problem so they can take it to the next election. That's why.
But people who get to the Senate are people who are accomplished politicians. They've usually worked their way up through the ranks and have a great deal of experience. And to be in the Senate, it seems to me, would be an aspiration because being in the Senate comes with all of the trappings that the Senate is known for, being this great deliberative body. So why would you want to run for the Senate if you want to shut all that down?
Well, you know, what's interesting about it is that it shocked, you know, newly elected senators that that's the way it worked. and, you know, you see it expressed publicly by senators, you know, that, you know, nothing's happening or they're not working on issues. It's shocking and so forth, because it is, because that's what you expect. I mean, if you think about some of the great debates in the United States Senate, I mean, that's what the Senate's all about, is having that opportunity to be out there. That's, you know, I was a part of a number of, you know, approaches and solutions to, you know, some issues over my time in the Senate was building consensus. I mean, and a lot of things happened that I was very proud of, that I worked on. But you can't almost imagine that today in the United States Senate. And that's exactly what happened, you know, during my time and in my final years there. That's what, you know, I came to terms with, that we weren't going to move forward on anything. We didn't have any amendments. We couldn't offer, you know, amendments to any of the bills pending on the floor of the Senate for the most part.
Former Maine Senator Olympia Snowe, our guest. Her book is called Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. And we'll get to some of the solutions that she suggests in her book when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia. This spring, delivering the 2014 all-wheel drive Subaru vehicles featuring the Impreza WRX and Impreza WRX STI sedan. Available at TyndallSubaru.com. Well, it's Friday, so coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, a panel of journalists will join guest host Tom Gjelten for analysis of the week's top domestic news stories. Some of those, Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki testifies before Congress on treatment delays at health clinics, the FCC votes on a net neutrality proposal, and more state high courts rule in favor of gay marriage. Those stories and more on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE. And we'll get back to our special conversation on Charlotte Talks with Olympia Snowe in just a moment.
The singer Hozier is becoming a sensation. Millions of listens online and a sold-out U.S. tour. He hails from Ireland, but his music is rooted in the blues.
The blues just feels like home to me. It just feels like I was raised with it around me.
Never feel too good in crowds.
Meet Hozier later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is former Maine Senator Olympia Snowe. Her book is called Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate for Congress. It is because she felt that Congress, and particularly the Senate, was broken, that she felt she needed to leave to fix it from the outside. And you say in your book that you believe the Senate can change, things can change, but you've issued a call to action to empower Americans who believe in bipartisanship to mobilize from the ground up to make that happen, to send an unmistakable message to lawmakers. How do you see that happening?
Well, in a number of ways. That's what I discuss in my speeches across the country, as well as with the Bipartisan Policy Senate. It's based here in Washington, founded by four former majority leaders of the United States Senate, two Democrats and two Republicans. And I'm co-chairing the Commission on Political Reform. By the way, we're having, we've had a town meeting at the Kennedy Library this month so that we can, focus on, many of the congressional reforms that are necessary. And we will be releasing a report on congressional political reforms on June 24th, as well as recommendations on how we can encourage, engagement in public service. But the point is here is that we do have to make some changes, and the public needs to be involved, frankly. We know that there are enough divisions out there for, forces for divisions, both organizationally and financially, that are driving the separation in the political system today that, doesn't value bipartisanship and consensus. So I think independent redistricting commissions are going to be essential in laying the groundwork for the 2020 reapportionment. There are about a dozen states already that have them in place. If we can get a number of other states to launch initiatives that put it on the ballot or through the state legislatures and the governors, would be one way of breaking up some of the homogenization of these congressional districts.
There are, I think the Senate is six senators shy of having a Republican majority, and the Republicans are working very hard to make that a reality in this midterm election. If that happens, what happens to the chances of this redistricting initiative that you're talking about and reaching any kind of greater bipartisan conversation? It seems to me if the Senate, if the Republicans control both houses of Congress, that's over.
Well, it would have to be adopted at the state legislative level because the reapportionment occurs.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so that will happen at that level. So that's why these state initiatives can be very important. In fact, is California, for example, adopted an independent redistricting commission that made a difference in ultimately coming to solutions regarding, their budgetary problems. Whether you agree or disagree, what they achieved, the point is they were able to solve their problems by virtue of the fact of changing their political system, making these seats more competitive so people are running, not just appealing to the far right or the far left, but to the middle. Because there is a broad swath of our country that wants our government to work are in the middle. So if there's a Republican majority in the House and Senate, hopefully they're going to be working towards governing and, not an overreach in what they, interpret for a mandate. Because, that has brought failure in the past and it'll bring failure in the future.
But they say that you get the government you deserve, didn't we, the people, decide that this is the government we wanted? Aren't these people in Congress because we, the people, put them there to do precisely, even though we complain about them not doing anything, we put them there to do precisely what they're doing?
Well, that may not always be the case, but you're right. I mean, we're a representative, government. We get the government we deserve and demand, and so we've got to change that. And that's what I'm, urging the public to do, is to look at candidates through the prism of their willingness to make government work, to make Congress work. And when the presidential campaign comes around in 2016, is demand of presidential candidates, how are they going to make it work? Because this current dysfunction and discord is affecting every American.
Well, how do you explain?
Because you can't address the issues.
Yeah, but how do you explain
the
this? I mean, President Obama was elected the first time around, and there was all this hope and change in the air, and none of that happened because of what because of obstructionism in the House and Senate, you've got senators and congresspeople and the president all elected, and it almost seems as though we're bipolar. We elect a guy to the White House, and he runs on one thing, and then we obstruct him with people on the other hand. Why do we do that?
Well, obviously, people looking at their own congressional districts or Senate seats, I don't think it was directly, to counter the president. I think there were a lot of people, a lot of Republicans who voted for President Obama on the basis of that hope and unity.
Is that because we don't understand? Is that because we as voters don't follow what the positions are and we don't understand exactly what we're doing when we go in and pull that lever in the voting booth?
Well, I think that, many people don't focus on it. And, and that's why I'm telling you they've got to. They've got to weigh in that silence is not golden in this instance, because otherwise you're going to continue to have the minority interest taking control of our political system. And that's not going to benefit them. It's not going to benefit their children. And it's not going to benefit the country. They have to become engaged in this process and demand accountability, in the debates. In the elections, find out what their positions are. And this social media and online technology, they ought to be able to do that. And also with a presidential election, because it's no more just, giving lip service. They have to demand that people are going to be willing to work across the aisle to get things done
but in these
that benefit this country.
These debates, these things that pose as presidential debates, they're not really debates. And the media is pretty soft on all these candidates when you compare it to what really happens in a parliamentary system, which we talked about earlier, where the media beats politicians to death and they in turn beat the media back. We don't have that. And a lot of times candidates simply dodge the question and they're never ask the question again. I mean, it's like you'll never get the answer, and you don't say, Senator Snow, you didn't answer my question. Answer my question. That doesn't happen. Why?
Right. I know. Because they have a lot of controls on both sides when they're developing these forums. But again,
if the process is jury-rigged against anything happening that's going to be meaningful, how can we get out of this?
We can change that, too. I mean, that's the other part of the equation. It doesn't prevent the press from asking, imposing those questions on specifics, to be very specific about it. And, basically, it's making the president and elected officials accountable and making the government work, and requiring, bipartisan leadership meetings on a regular basis between the president and the Congress. It's no longer an inside the beltway issue. It's critical to the functioning of our government and to this country. Have the president, be obviously maybe in the future we should have the president having some kind of a question and answer period. Make people accountable, because accountability is absolutely paramount in this instance. We can't have people, running our government on the basis in which they're doing today. And think that our country is going to be able to respond to the major issues and it doesn't affect and imperil our future. And we're not talking long, long term here when you think about some of the problems that are on the horizon that will affect the quality of our life in America for jobs. I mean, what about the average person who should have a decent paying job today in America? I mean, Congress isn't working on those issues that will make a profound difference. And settling our financial problems and tax reform, all of the issues that would matter, that could turn this economy around and would help the average American and provide the opportunities people deserve in this country.
I want to get to some of your solutions, but Sam from Charlotte emails, why doesn't a group of moderate Democrats and Republicans, I would imagine fiscally conservative, socially liberal, break away to form a third middle party that would be an extremely powerful swing vote? 30 parties are not going to come from the ground up. I would love to see no-nonsense people like Senator Snow and Senator McCain join up with some Democrats who would actually get some entitlement reform through and balance the budget while remaining progressive socially. Any chance of that ever happening, do you think?
Well, by and large, that's what has to happen. I mean, not, you know, on the third party part, I mean, obviously, I mean, people will look for a third way if the two parties cannot, you know, manage these institutions of governance effectively. I mean, ultimately, that's what happened, because they're in the hands of Republicans and Democrats, both the presidency and the United States Congress. And if it doesn't change, then people, yes, will look for a third way. You saw one of the recent polls, and it might have been Gallup, that showed, you know, the highest number of people now, you know, describing themselves as independents, I think at 42%, because people are, I mean, they're fearful about the future, but they are fed up and angry about the direction, you know, of Congress.
Well,
and
if the majority of Americans are in the middle, why is all the focus on the far left and the far right? Why is there hay to be made, money to be made, by candidates pandering to those sides when the vast majority of voters are in the middle?
Because they worry about getting through a primary. And that's where that's the problem.
So that's why you're calling.
Let me put it this way. You know, there was an analysis done back in 1987, just to give you an example. In 1987, where there were 57 senators who represented one party, but their states voted for the presidential candidate of the other party. Today, there are only 21 in that category. So, you know, I mean, that's basically 79 senators who, you know, don't, you know, have a political incentive to work across the aisle because they're going to get a tough primary.
And that's why you're calling for open primaries, correct?
Yes.
What is an open
right.
primary, and what has to happen to make that a reality?
Well, there are various iterations. I'd say this to allow independents. Again, it's a state, you know, a decision because they determine, you know, election rules, is to allow independents, for example, to vote in primaries. There are various forms of it. I mean, for example, I guess probably one of the more I think one of the more extreme ones would be in California, where, for example, you have the top two vote getters. I'm not sure I prefer that, but nevertheless, you know, so it would be irrespective of whether or not there's a Republican Democrat. It could be two Democrats, as it was in a congressional race recently. But the point is allowing more independents to vote in these primaries. And so there are various forms and iterations, and obviously it would be up to the states. But the point is to dilute the ideological influence and impact in these campaigns.
You also believe that we need to roll back Citizens United, which has led big corporate money and let it into the electoral process. How did you feel the impact during that time, your time in the Senate, and how do you roll it back given that it's a Supreme Court decision?
Well, you know, obviously that's going to be the big challenge and hurdle, which is, you know, obviously anything short of a constitutional amendment is going to be difficult. But I think that is, you know, an issue that has to be addressed. One, I would ban leadership PACs for starters. I mean, you know, most members of Congress today have a leadership PAC above and beyond their political action committees for their own reelection. They have to raise, you know, other sums of money for a PAC that they can give to their colleagues and other candidates. That's a whole other level of fundraising that takes time away from the job and whole other pressures. The other thing is perhaps more accountability and disclosure of these third-party groups and who's donating to these organizations. You know, I tried to draw a line with my provision that said on issue advocacy and survived the first challenge before the Supreme Court and obviously didn't survive the most recent. But to draw a line 60 days before an election and 30 days before a primary, where if ads were run that identified, you know, an elected official by name on how to vote on a particular issue, then that would constitute an electioneering ad or designed to influence the outcome. If they didn't identify, you know, the elected official, for example, they just said senator instead of saying Senator Snow, then it would be considered an issue advocacy ad. It wouldn't be considered, you know, a political ad. Therefore, they would, you know, if there was a political ad, then they would have to work, you know, they would have to form a political action committee and come under the constraints of that limited contributions and all the other restrictions that are around political action committees, rather than the open-ended spending that you see today.
You're also suggesting, and I love this, a permanent mandate that if Congress fails to pass a budget or appropriation bills are not completed, its members, the congressional members, should not get paid. given that the House or Senate would have to vote on that themselves, what's the chance of that ever happening?
Well, that's something that the public has to drive and insist on. And, you know, they did pass a form of it on a temporary basis at the beginning of the new Congress in 2013. It said no budget, no pay, to a point, which was that if each chamber didn't pass a budget, then they wouldn't receive pay, but didn't talk about the fact that it had to become law, which, by the way, a budget resolution is required to be passed by April 15th. That didn't happen for three consecutive years in the United States Senate. I mean, you know, we saw everything fundamental that's happened in Congress today is around the budget issues, the failure to do their jobs. And the same was true, and I argued this point when I was there. I mean, didn't pass budgets and didn't do the appropriation bills and didn't do the things that were necessary and fundamental. So that's why this becomes, I think, so pivotal, and the public needs to demand it.
I have less than a minute left, but you advocate a five-day work week at least 3 weeks a month for people serving in Congress. How would that differ from what we have now, and why is that important?
Well, the way I describe it is that the basic schedule in the United States Senate would be that we'd have a bed check vote when we came back in on Monday night at 5:30. And by Thursday, everybody smelled jet fumes and was putting pressure on the leadership to leave. So you had very few days in which to work, and everything was concentrated in those days, and therefore not much got done in terms of the big issues.
So stick around for 5 days, stay there over the weekend, build collegiality, and then go home for one week of a year.
Yeah, get to know each other, too. That might help.
Okay. Other suggestions on how we can fix the stalemate in Congress from Senator Olympia Snowe can be found in her book, Fighting for Common Ground. Thank you for the hour. Interesting conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. Delighted to be here this morning. Thank you.